This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
Every once in a while, the Center of Workforce Innovations here in Northwest Indiana puts out a report on the status of the labor market in the region. And let's find out more about the latest report and also some information behind the numbers. We have with us today Robin Minton Holmes, who's the Vice President for Workforce Initiatives with the Center of Workforce Innovations. And with us as well, Allison Bertle, and she is Work One Business Services Manager. Ladies, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having us.
Give us an idea from the latest report how we stand on things like the workforce, about unemployment or employment in general.
Well, the good news is that we are seeing our unemployment rate start to decline, which is really good news. We have been on the unemployment rate reached a high in like 2008 to 2010 because of the recession. But with the most recent numbers, we're actually have a 4.4% unemployment rate. And what that means is that there are more people working, and we're excited about that. There are jobs for people. And there are still some of us that have been left out, left behind, and still need to be employed. But that number has gotten smaller and smaller.
From the information that you get, well, maybe we should start out here by I'll just ask the question, where do you all get the information that you're able to put together for the report?
These numbers are the report numbers actually come from the state of Indiana, Department of Workforce Development, and they're all a formula that's created by the federal government that's been established for a really long time.
In looking at the data, and you've been able to, of course, take a look back at months and even years behind that as well, what kinds of trends do you get to be able to see and tell people about, especially businesses and industry, or prospective businesses and industry for that matter, too, that are interested in Northwest Indiana? What can you tell them about what type of labor force is available for them to be able to take advantage of?
Well, I do think it's important to also note first that the greatest contributor to the decline of our unemployment rate is primary metals in the past month. They've added about 1,000 jobs in the last month. With as it comes to the specifics about business services and what employers are seeing, I'm going to ask Allison to sort of chime in here.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, when we talk about the largest gain being in primary metals and manufacturing, you've got a lot of different things happening throughout the region. You've got businesses like American Rent-A-Lent who are adding jobs in LaPorte County, adding a new line and producing more jobs available to the county. You've got new businesses that are coming to the region. For example, MCP out of Portage, they're working on getting up and running now. Cameco, another large organization producing manufacturing jobs, going to be up and running by June. So there's a lot of growth that's happening, which is a result of that large gain.
It's always nice to be able to hear good news like that, because we've had so much bad news over the decades, it seems, since the steel industry started going into a slump, not only a production slump, a sales slump as well. And we've unfortunately seen the activities at the mills decline so dramatically. And they've had, of course, retooled to make it into the high-tech era to be able to run more efficiently. Are we finding that more of these smaller businesses, like the ones that you've mentioned so far, they're coming into Northwest Indiana or expanding in Northwest Indiana, are taking advantage of the most technological ways to be able to produce a product?
You know, by far and above, Indiana is just a really good place to do business. Mm-hmm. And we have demonstrated abilities here in Northwest Indiana to be able to produce the kind of workforce that those individuals need. And we do a lot of that through training and really strong education partners throughout the region. And so that demonstrated effort really gives employers confidence when they come to Northwest Indiana that even if we don't have the workforce they need right this moment, that it is something that can be created. And there's a team of people here in Northwest Indiana that can help make that happen.
Well, I know, yeah, Allison, that's your department, so to speak, working with Work One. What directions do you get to pass along to your colleagues in Indianapolis, the bosses in Indianapolis that are always wondering how the employment situation is doing up here, and what in turn they can pass along to you that will allow you to be able to help get the workforce to the place that it should be?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of times when we see unemployment rates declining, that means that we have to shift some strategies that we typically deploy when we're talking about workforce. Mm-hmm. And so it means that we are not only working with those who are unemployed, but we're also doing more work for those who are employed and helping them to increase their skills to help them move up into positions as those companies expand, so that as we're working with those lower skilled individuals, it creates opportunities for them to backfill. Here in Northwest Indiana, we have a wide variety of different monetary resources for employers and businesses across the region when it comes to how they go about upskilling that workforce and making that happen. We use credentials so that those skills are very translatable across employers throughout the region and throughout the state. And so using those resources and taking advantage of those is something that it's really important for employers to tap into, especially if they're in some kind of expansion or growth mode.
I think, too, as we thinking about the labor pool that's left that still needs to be employed, and also thinking about how the unemployment rate has declined, it's important that now employers have to look at what are the skills of their existing workers and evaluate, you know, how do I keep these workers so that they don't jump ship for perhaps a job that pays better somewhere else. So that's where Allison and the team are really working with employers across the region to help them get incumbent worker training, which we can help pay for here at the center. And once we work with those incumbent workers, then oftentimes we'll see a slight wage increase for the worker. They move up, which, as Allison was saying, then opens up slots for those who perhaps have been underskilled or unemployed for a while to get back into the workforce with skill development. So the incumbent worker training opportunity that we have is really great. And if employers are interested in learning more about how we can help them get their existing workforce trained so that they can hang on to their good workers, they can get in touch with us here at the center in Allison, and some of the team members can meet with them.
That's Robin Minton Holmes, who is the Vice President for Workforce Initiatives with the Center of Workforce Innovations here in Northwest Indiana. And with her today, Allison Bertle, who is the Work One Business Services Manager. Thank you very much for being with us to give us this good news that things are improving, not only on the employment scene, but improving on how businesses are being able to find the workers that they have. And you're able to do your best to get people trained for the jobs that are being created here in Northwest Indiana. Thanks for spending your time with us today to talk about it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Several Northwest Indiana organizations are moving toward improving the local economy and enhancing the region's quality of place through the creation of a region-wide plan. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson talked recently with Heather Ennis, who's the president and CEO of the Northwest Indiana Forum, about the development of the plan and its goals.
For those who don't know, can you tell us what the Northwest Indiana Forum is and what its purpose is?
Sure. So we are the voice of Northwest Indiana business and the 7-county economic development organization covering Lake, Porter, LaPorte, Jasper, Newton, Pulaski, and Stark counties. So it is our job to tell the story of Northwest Indiana, going out and promoting the region, attracting businesses to come here, acting as the voice of Northwest Indiana business from a public policy perspective, as well as bringing together parties and operating as a united front for developing a vision for the region and helping to work with partners across the region to really capitalize on the opportunities that we have here in the region. So
tell me about the Northwest Indiana Forum and the development of the Regional Economic Development Strategic Playbook.
Yeah, so it's been a while in the process. We've been working on this. Initially, we were kind of reorganizing the strategic plan of the forum, but then we realized economic development works with a broad base of partners and a broad base of opportunities to move all of these assets together and move the partnerships together more cohesively. So we have not had an economic development regional plan previously. We've got the 2040 plan and we've got the Marquette plan. We've got other plans that have great goals and aspirations, but not anything that cohesively works economic development all together and what that means and how we're all operating together. So we went through the process of bringing in an outside consultant to talk with us about this because, of course, it's nice to get some perspective on it. Sometimes we can't see the forest through the trees, and having an outside company come in and look helps us to really evaluate the opportunities that are right here in front of us. So we went through a pretty stringent vetting process to bring on TIP strategies, and we're extremely excited about them. They came very highly recommended from people all over the country, and they've been engaged in a wide variety of opportunities such as this. But mostly, the thing that we found, two points that we found very exciting about them, is that they'd worked over large geographical areas that had varied interests and multiple jurisdictions, similarly to the makeup of Northwest Indiana. And then on the back end, they really produce a pragmatic playbook that helps give timelines and action items. And so it's an action-oriented plan. It's not something that is designed to sit on a shelf or you know, designed to be looked at or a coffee table book. This is actually an action-oriented, implementable plan. So we're very, very excited about that and the opportunity to use this plan to really make some dramatic improvements on the cohesiveness of the region as a whole.
And you say action, and the action is to, the goal of the action is to what? Bring more businesses into Northwest Indiana to sell it? To
help grow the economy of Northwest Indiana, whether that's through working with partners to encourage a environment of entrepreneurship and innovation, whether it's attracting new business here, helping the business that's here to grow. You know, and again, this is not a plan for the forum, it's a plan for the region as a whole. So developing workforce and helping attract the workforce that fits in line with the talent that we need to make our companies that are here successful, as well as we diversify our economy and being able to attract the workers that are needed for a more diverse economy. So it is a playbook that we're working across many sectors and with many regional partners on, and talking about how we build upon the double tracking in the Westlake and what those opportunities that the RDA is working so hard on, what they bring to the region, and how we then can actuate those into opportunities for company growth and community growth.
So when you've met your goal, what will that look like? How will the region be different and look different?
So, you know, as we talk about aspirations for the region, one of vibrancy and enthusiasm and hope and collaboration and cooperation and with it, where we actually feel like the assets are being well utilized and working in tandem and not so siloed. So I think that we're seeing more and more opportunities for municipalities and organizations to work together to bring some of these things to fruition. And it's really a case of many hands making light work and all of us rowing in the same general direction.
So what assets do you think are siloed? You mean like capitalizing on the new additions and the new improvements at like the Gary Chicago International Airport and things of that nature?
Absolutely. To be able to build on the expanded runway at the airport, as I talked about, to be able to take advantage of the enhanced commuter rail times that will be coming from the double tracking in the Westlake corridor, utilizing the Port of Indiana and really attracting companies or helping companies to expand that can use that as an asset, and really helping others to understand what that asset is and how we build upon that. Continuing to tout our great economic climate, but also the wonderful quality of life that we have here in Northwest Indiana and the great work that's being done by many other organizations to continue to improve on that and continue to boost that. So I'm very bullish on the future of Northwest Indiana and excited about what we have as assets and what the opportunities are to continue to build upon those. I think that we haven't lived up to our full potential yet, and I think that's going to continue to grow in the coming years.
So now that you've teamed up with TIP Strategies, which is Austin and Seattle based, you say, based in Austin and Seattle, what is the next step in the process here?
So we had TIP out in March and again in April, and they've been meeting with stakeholders in the region. We'll be circling back. We have TIP back out at the end of May. They'll be here again in June, July, and then we'll roll out the plan in August. So this is a quick, intensive study of the region, and then with an action-oriented plan on the back end. So it is truly, the goal is to have something that is workable and can make a dramatic impact with some step-by-step opportunities of how we get there and agreement from the business community and the governmental agencies in the area to say, okay, yeah, this is the direction we want to go, and this is how we're going to get there, how we're moving forward. So it's a quick process, but it is a very in-depth one and one that we're living and breathing as we speak. So it's been a lot of fun.
That's Northwest Indiana Forum's President and CEO Heather Ennis speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson. This is Regionally Speaking. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
The newspaper did a whole project looking at race. The executive editor at the time, Eileen Brown, decided to take 1 year to look at race and its impact on Northwest Indiana, looking at all of the institutions, schools, police, politics, transportation, all of those elements. Me being kind of, you know, basic smart alecky reporter, said, well, I want to look at the role of that the Post Tribune played, the role of the newspaper. Not really understanding just where that was going to go, but figuring that if we're going to talk about anything, we should start with talking about us. So I had to go back through actual newspaper archives and databases and LexisNexis searches, and I would count up things like how many times Richard Hatcher was mentioned in the paper. And it was like since he had left office, it was still well over 2,000, approaching 3,000 mentions. It would seem like it was a real fascination. And we had this little, it's like primitive Twitter, basically. It was a column called Quickly, where people could call into this to the newspaper, or they could write to the newspaper. People were really just starting to email even at that point. And they would have their little comments. This was based on a project that they had in Atlanta. And usually people would complain about the Falcons or stuff like that. It was all, you know, like, traffic's bad here. But more often than not, in Northwest Indiana, people would just mention race in those comments. Race, racism, racial. And you could just count up all of those, and it just happened all the time. And there was one incident in particular where Richard Gordon Hatcher was mentioned. He was trying to get some money for his Civil Rights Hall of Fame. And there were a number of comments in Quickly on this. Most of them were negative. Most of them were negative. Shouldn't give him, don't do this, whatever. But a handful of them were positive, supporting him or just supporting the project or the mayor himself, you know, the former mayor. And the way it worked is that those comments that were negative, they ran in all editions of the Post Tribune, the ones that were in Porter County and Lake County and the suburbs, as well as the city. The ones, and they were only a handful, but the handful that were positive and praised the mayor, those were only run in Gary. The Post Tribune would write articles about how, you know, such and such teacher who had taught in Gary at Frable for 20 years was leaving Gary to go to wherever. And it's like, he's just thinking like, why are we writing stories about people leaving the town? How is that helping anything? They were helped creating their own narrative. Everybody's leaving. You know, it's almost like, and are you next? When are you going to leave now? Well, what about you? Where's your house in Merrillville or your house there in the suburbs? And that it actually helped create a drumbeat that helped empty out the city. Their own coverage began to contribute to what was going on in Gary.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Fewer than 20% of people with disabilities were employed last year. That's according to a Department of Labor report. A two-year program called Inspire at Franklin College aims to give students with special needs a traditional college experience. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright continues in her series saying that Inspire also prepares these students for a career and life.
Allie Callahan was diagnosed with autism when she was 5. But as she stocks an equipment closet at an Indianapolis hospital, it's clear it doesn't slow her down.
This is for the nurses. This is for the Band-Aids, for the patients.
Allie is an intern with Project Search, a work-based state program. She works 5 days a week at Community North Hospital. This is her last rotation in the maternity unit. She works closely with department staff, and as she walks through the halls, she knows almost everyone's name.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi, honey. How are you?
Good.
She restocks large bins full of pink and blue hats, diapers, and bottle nipples. She uses a daily checklist to keep track of what needs restocked and in what rooms. Allie seems unfazed by the work, but she had a little help getting here. Allie graduated from the Inspire program at Franklin College last year. Her mother, Diane, says it helped her grow into the person she is today.
First of all, her confidence has soared, just absolutely soared. Her level of independence has increased.
Allie also has improved her time management and social skills. That's what Inspire leaders want to see. Lead job coach Alicia Webb says the goal is for students to find paid employment once they graduate.
We're always constantly talking about social appropriateness and how to handle a situation, problem solve, and teaching them to speak up in a natural environment. That's what's the beauty of this college.
Inspire started in 2013. 10 students are enrolled, and every day they practice skills they can apply in the real world. Right now, they're playing the game of life in their Inspire 100 class.
A bill is a bill adding to your deposit, or is it taking away from your money?
The students are given a profession, like a coffee barista, for example. They then make decisions based on how much money they make, how many bills they have to pay, and more. But in addition to the classroom work, Webb says the students actually go out on campus and practice what they've learned.
How can we, you know, introduce ourselves to someone? I mean, you're actually going up to someone and doing it. It is hands-on experience.
That's why Project Search job coach Kelly Pattison says transitional programs for students with disabilities are so important. They create normal environments for them to succeed in. She says they often just need a little extra support.
When they go into a department and they're asked to do something that maybe they've never been able to do, and then somebody just takes the time to show them, that's all they needed, and now they can do it and they're confident about it.
She says about 80% find paid jobs at the end of the 9-month internship. Sometimes, she says, they even find work at the hospital. Community North currently employs 21 Project Search graduates. Diane says it's necessary to set the bar high for students like Allie, because they're capable of doing more than people think.
Just not knowing what the future holds is scary for any of our young adults, our children. But I think it's, well, I know it's even more so when limits are placed on them.
And it not only improves the students' lives, but also the communities around them. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
We understand that Allie graduated from her internship last month, and she hopes to get a job working at a hospital, but she also plans to work at a new boutique that is opening this month through the Alex and Allie Foundation. It's called Hope Gallery. The goal is to enhance the lives of those with developmental disabilities but for helping provide employment opportunities and community involvement. Indiana Youth Institute has put out an op-ed piece penned by next guest here on Regionally Speaking by Tammy Silverman, who's the executive director of the IYI. And the topic name for this op-ed piece is called Building a Healthier State from the Child Up. Tammy, thank you for joining us today.
Always my pleasure, Chris. Happy to be here.
Well, if you will, fill us in with the topic and why that particular title for it.
Certainly. Well, right now there is a new initiative going on across the state called the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana. And this is a group of healthcare professionals, the Hospital Association, a couple of the big hospital firms, as well as some of those state agencies, Public Health and FSSA. And they started looking at four big issues for health in Indiana. And the role we're playing is looking at what that means for kids, right? Where does Indiana's health for, how are our children doing on some of those really important health metrics?
And unfortunately, how did the rankings show Indiana?
Well, unfortunately, right now, Indiana ranks 35th overall for children's health in the United States. So 35th out of 50. It shows that we have some significant room to grow, particularly in the areas of smoking, infant mortality, obesity, and opioid use disorder.
Now, these are topics that we've brought up in many times before in past discussions and problems that Indiana has. It doesn't sound like this report tells us anything really new, does it?
It's not. But I think one of the important things, particularly, you know, recently we've heard an awful lot about infant mortality, and right now there is that is an area that we continue to struggle with, as well as the opioid use disorder.
Yeah.
I will tell you, though, I think we've kind of, because those things have been so front and center, that the impact of smoking on our kids, as well as the obesity rate, sometimes feel like those stories that we've already covered enough, if you will. But unfortunately, it's still a struggle for kids in Indiana, and so we still need to keep talking about it.
When you've had a chance to do the research on this here, what are we finding as well? We talk about the problems with the opioid abuse disorder among adults, but what do the figures seem to show as far as young people, babies and children alike?
Well, what we know is that obviously newborns who are exposed to opioids before they're born, they have a 60 to 80% likelihood of suffering from what's called neonatal abstinence syndrome, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a mouthful, but it really does affect their long-term language abilities, their cognitive abilities, academic achievement, as well as their long-term growth. So big issues there. We also know that kids who are growing up in homes where opioids are present are just by being there and by there's secondary traumatic stress. And so they're really dealing with what that means to live in that stressful situation where they may be exposed to acute neglect. We're finding that a lot of those parents don't actively abuse the kids. They're not intentionally harming them, but their addiction may cause them to neglect those kids, and which could have some really long-term consequences.
Now, what kind of information do you folks there at the Indiana Youth Institute get from the Indiana Department of Child Services on this particular topic? Anything new or anything in particular that you're learning?
Well, we are. We're talking to them. You know, they've had a huge increase in the number of children that have been removed from their homes, and they say that the number one cause is that parental substance abuse, and particularly opioids. It's not the only one, but it is what's caused that jump in the last 3 years in particular. So what we're really doing is working with them to figure out how can we help all of those support networks for kids, be it grandparents, aunts, uncles, teachers, coaches, youth group leaders. We know those kids that are in those homes are struggling an awful lot, and the more that we as adults can wrap around them and provide them additional supports, the better off they'll be long term.
Now we're into the summer months, or at least something like it now, and we're finding with the fact that school's out and there are more opportunities for such events happening during the summer months before school starts in the fall. Are we finding more activities around the state of Indiana that you folks at the IYI are noting that are helping to educate the public on these issues or to help in some small way resolve them?
Certainly. Well, and like I said, the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana, which is, they're doing kind of a statewide roadshow talking about these issues, and we're joining them on that roadshow to talk about all four of those issues. I will say summertime is one of those things where we need to make sure our kids are active, that we need to make sure that goes right to that obesity rate. We need to make sure that they're getting up off the couch and putting down some of those devices and really getting out and doing whatever those activities might be. They can be as simple as shooting basketball hoops, or they can be attending a camp, right, where mm-hmm. there's physical activity. We know that one of the pieces of research that we found out is that habits around food and physical activity develop at a really early age. Some of the research is saying by age 5 or 7. So from a really young age, we need to make sure that kids understand the importance of eating healthy foods and being physically active every day.
And we know it's a lot easier to say than it is to do, so I know it's a chore to get some of the youngsters away from the games or the television or the computer for that matter and be able to get out and do these things here. Are there any interesting things that you've heard of around the state that are ways to be able to be more creative in ways of getting young people out there and getting that exercise that they really need?
Sure. And I think it's really being that modeling and getting up with them and offering, again, to go for a walk around the neighborhood. Sometimes they can be these really orchestrated activities, but sometimes it's just taking a walk after dinner every night. You know, it doesn't have to be a big undertaking. One of the formulas that some of these experts suggested, which I think is easy for families to remember, is 5-2-1-0. Mm-hmm. So the 5 is 5 fruits and vegetables a day. 2 is no more than 2 hours of screen time. That's everything from television, phone, iPad, whatever it may be. 1 hour of physical activity every day and 0 sugary drinks. So 5-2-1-0 is one of those formulas that we can kind of keep in our minds. Doesn't mean it's always going to happen. You know, I'm a mom of 2 kids as well, and getting them sometimes to put down those devices is difficult. But if we talk about what we're shooting for every day, we're more likely to get there.
I certainly hope that's a program that's very easy to be able to perform for any youngsters here in Indiana and in Northwest Indiana in particular. And we hope that there'll be some more great ideas coming out of the IYI about this as well. We've been talking with Tammy Silverman, who is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. She's recently put out an op-ed piece. It's available to see on their website, IYI.org, and check that out for yourself if you'd like to get more information. And, of course, the website has lots of information about ways that you can help youngsters across the state as well as here in your neighborhood be able to get the help that they may need to deal with the problems that by not means their fault, certainly, that they have to be foisted with these days. Tammy, as always, thank you for spending time with us to talk about it.
Always my pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
The 19th annual fundraising walk to benefit the Sojourner Truth House in Gary is coming up this Saturday. Sherita Brewer was with us on Regionally Speaking to talk about first the facility itself, who it benefits, and then about the walk.
Sojourner Truth House was founded in 1997 by Sisters from the Poor Handmaids of Jesus Christ, which is an order in Donaldson, who wanted to give back to the community by helping women. The primary focus of Sojourner Truth House is delivered through three streams of service. Mm-hmm. They serve homeless women and children who are housed at four local shelters by providing them with basic education training, with skills learning, financial literacy, assistance when they need some counseling for substance abuse issues or mental health issues. They give them access to services in the community so that they can then get the help that they need with those specialized things and other things. And with the ultimate goal of bringing them to a point where they're able to be more self-sustainable and getting them into permanent and safe housing. Mm-hmm. And then the second stream of service is the program called TOPS, which is Transitional Outreach Program Participants. And those are clients who have been housed, who are formerly homeless, who are now in their own housing, but who may still benefit from recovery treatment programs or literacy programs. They may be in the middle of applying for benefits and things like that that might take them longer than just to get into housing. Third stream, which is actually the largest number, is those in the community who have intermittent emergency needs. And they are folks who are the working poor or those who've been affected by the economy and perhaps not able to find work, and they are able to come once a month for food and every 3 months for personals and for clothing. And one of the nicest things about Sojourner Truth House is that we recognize that while you could possibly get a food stamp card and be able to get food, you then cannot get personal items, personal hygiene items, feminine products, things for your children and things like that. So we have one of the largest food pantries in the area, but also one of the few that actually provide personal items.
Wow, wow. How many clients per month would you say that the house gets to serve?
We serve an average of 2,162 clients per month.
Wow.
So that's people that are coming in, that are walking in, some single persons and some with families, upwards of 6 or 8 or 10 people in the house.
So how many children would you say that probably covers as well?
Out of that, probably about half of them are children.
Wow, wow. Now, we ask about the Sojourner Truth House itself and what they do, because everything that is raised from the annual fundraising walk goes directly back into the operations of the house, and that's why it's very important to show your support for it through the 19th annual walk for the Sojourner Truth House. If you will, Sherita, tell us where it's going to start on Saturday, June 9th, and where hopefully will end, and what people should do if they're interested in participating.
Okay. We will actually be taking the walk from the front of Sojourner Truth House, which is at 410 West 13th Avenue in downtown Gary, so that's at the corner of 13th and Madison, directly across from Frabel Park. Mm-hmm. The walk, the full route of the walk is 1.6 miles, and it basically goes around the park, out to Broadway, back down to 11th Avenue, and then back up and around Madison back to the ministry. There is also a shorter route for people who may want to take a shorter route or who may run the route. Some people will run several times, and that is around Frabel Park. So that's probably mm-hmm. maybe the equivalent of about six city blocks.
Mm-hmm. That's still, that's pretty good sized parking. So that's a pretty good sized walk to begin with there, even in its own right, I would imagine. So,
absolutely.
That's good. So getting started here on Saturday, June 9th, about, I guess, with the check-in about 8 o'clock in the morning and the kickoff for the walk about an hour later. How many people tend to participate in the walk, that, and certainly based on the years that you've been able to keep track of it?
In the years that I've been there, we have had anywhere from 300 to 500 participants. I want to also note that our honorary chair is the Honorable Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, and she's been a staunch supporter of Sojourner Truth House for a number of years.
Yeah.
And Bishop Don Hying is going to be our Grand Marshal, so he'll be with us again for the third year in a row this year.
Now, Shrita, I have to ask you before we finish up here, do any of the folks who take advantage of the house actually help participate in the walk?
Absolutely. From year to year, we will have actual clients who do everything from help with greeting people when they come in. They have been a part of our warm-up exercises in the past. You will see them at different stations. And one of the most wonderful things is the fact that as you see our clients look like everyone. So you won't necessarily notice, or they won't look like they should be receiving services. But that's the wonderful thing about Sojourner Truth House. We don't discriminate. People come to us where they are, and we want to get them where they want to be and to assimilate them into our interpretation of.
That's going to be on June 9th, by the way, if you're interested. Is there any place that people can get more information or they can get hold of you to ask about it?
They can register at walk4sth.org. Once again, that's walk4, spelled out F-O-R-S-T-H.org, or they can call our special events coordinator at 947-8665. And registration, once again, is at 8 o'clock. The walk kicks off at 9 o'clock. You'll also have an opportunity to participate in some of the wellness events. We have a wellness tent there. There will be vendors there, and we'll be giving tours of the ministry so that people can see the different departments and see how their dollars will be spent.
That's Shrita Brewer with the Sojourner Truth House in Gary. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Northwest Indiana Food Bank is in the process of moving all of its operations from a warehouse that it outgrew in Gary to a much larger facility in Merivale. I had a chance recently to visit the new facility and talk with the food bank's executive director, Steve Beekman. Well, Steve, you have a very, very nice place now. Certainly, I understand triple the amount of room that you had in the current space in Gary. Tell us, first off, how you came across such a wonderful place to locate the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, and a little bit about the building and what you're hoping to do here.
What's important is to make sure that we have enough room and storage to be able to accept all food donations and food products that we acquire and distribute to our network agencies. That's most important. So we obviously need to be close next to freeways to be able to have that excess of trucks being able to come to our facility, including docks, which we don't currently have at our current location. So that's critically important, but also having the room and the space to accommodate all the number of volunteers that we get on an annual basis, because without volunteers, we're not able to do what we can do. So we have about 2,000 volunteers that come out and just to repack, sort, and put together all the meals that we distribute out, about 4.5 million meals annually that we distribute, and we can't do that without large groups of volunteers coming out to help.
Part of the, I know, of the plan to relocate the food bank, as you mentioned, is not only to give yourself plenty of room to be able to do everything that needs to be done, but the opportunity to be close to the sources. And you kind of mentioned the fact that obviously the highway is going to be a very important part of this. What's been the problem that you encountered over the years being in the location in Gary that you hope that you'll be able to completely alleviate by being here in Merivale? Mm-hmm.
Well, the location, the barn where we're currently at, is about 12,000 square foot. It's a barn that's been repurposed into a food bank. And so this lacks a docks and proper storage. So that in itself has been a significant challenge for us. And then the location, the proximity of freeway is important for us because we accept a lot of truckloads of donated product, purchased product. So that's critically important for us. So the barn has served a great purpose for us for many, many years. But because of the large need in our area and the need that we need to grow and to be able to provide more meals, we needed to find a better location to accept more food so we can distribute out to better to our network agencies throughout the region. So that's the Hammond, East Chicago, Gary, Porter County, Valparaiso, Chesterton. We need to provide more meals to the whole region. So we identified a building that will be able to not only have that easy access, but also be able to store all this type of product.
With this opportunity that you have, with this extra space that you have here now, it's obviously going to be for storage, for food, and be able to process things. But you talk about the effort that you have with volunteers to create the meals that in turn go out from the food bank. What are you hoping that you can set up in this extra space now that you haven't been able to do over in Gary?
Yes. So the lack of space at our current facility limits us not only with the food capacity, but program-wise. And so with this new space, we know that hunger and food insecurity is a major significant issue here in Northwest Indiana, and we need to provide long-term solutions to these problems. So if we're able to create these different type of robust programs and innovative approaches, we know we can serve the community better, and we're going to use the power of food to make that transformation. A lot of the programs we want to do is do a culinary job training program to teach people, unemployed or unemployed, basic skills to get them job employment, if it's warehouse job training. We know that financial stability is the number one way to get out of poverty and food insecurity. So we're trying to leverage this space and our ability to get food to make that a reality to so many people here in the region.
We're talking to Steve Beekman, who's the executive director of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. They are relocating from their location in Gary into a much, much larger and much more visible location on Broadway in Maryville. The address is 6490 Broadway, but let's just say that if you get to 61st at the light and you go south on Broadway, when you get to the railroad tracks, if you cross the tracks, you've gone too far. But that's the nice central area, and in fact, you happen to be right next door, literally, to a food processing plant of sorts here. The North Star Ice Cream Novelties plant is right next door to the food bank facility here. And obviously, they're not going to be probably much part of the food bank, but it's probably nice to have them as a neighbor, I would imagine.
Well, I mean, we're always good to have any type of neighbors, but yes.
I mean, it'd be certainly easy for people to find, and that's the point, so that organizations that rely on the food bank to supply their food pantries and the like will be able to easily, as you say, get to not only the supplies, but also to be able to get to the food bank itself. One of the things I know the food bank is working on is not only a capital campaign that's helping flesh out everything that you want to do here for this facility, but also for an even larger project too, a $4 million capital campaign that would create a hunger relief facility. Tell us about that.
Yes. So this capital campaign with a $4 million goal is to get us into this new location, to be able to build out all the new innovative programs that we want to create these long-term solutions to hunger. So this campaign will bring that to the region and be able to have this facility to be the central hub of a lot of that activity. If it's additional volunteer engagement, if it's more meals to people with seniors and kids, to people that need just an extra help and support to get them back on track and be self-sustaining.
What are projects ahead coming up going into the summer months for the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, so we do have a fundraising event called the Soiree, June 10th. So our tickets are on sale now. That's a fundraiser to help with our general operating expenses for here at the Food Bank. And so we encourage people to go online, to come visit, have some of the best tastes, sounds, and music and foods that the region has. And so we encourage people to come out for that. But for programming-wise, we are starting our summer food service program where we're providing kids and youth summer meals throughout the summer. And we expect to serve about 400 kids daily, a breakfast and lunch during the summer months. And our senior box program called the CSFP program, that continues. We're serving 1,034 seniors every month, a 32-pound box of food that these seniors qualify for. And it's such an amazing program, and this program continues to grow. And we're happy to be able to provide those meals to our hungry seniors.
Now, we know that the food bank has been primarily centered around Lake County, of course, because they've been in Gary. And you'd like to do some expansion as well to some of the surrounding counties as well, too. Do you think that being in this new location on Broadway and Merrillville will help you achieve that goal?
Currently, we serve Lake and Porter County. And so that's been our efforts. That's kind of our service area that defined by us and to Feeding America. The service area that we've been providing, this building will be able to, at some point, be able to serve the need in our area, which is about 17 million meals. So currently we're doing 4.5 at our current location, and we've exceeded our capacity. So this new building will be able to at least get us to meet the need currently in the region. So in the future, if there's ability to go beyond Lake and Porter County, we believe this facility could probably be able to allow us to do that.
And obviously being so close to I-65 will help too, I would imagine.
Yes, yes, yes.
What's been the reaction to the folks here in Northwest Indiana once the words have gotten around, and certainly in the planning stages of getting into this new facility here on Broadway, to being able to do this triple expansion of the food bank?
Yes, I think it's awareness is the biggest thing I see. Even our agencies too, or some of our donors, had no idea how big the issues are and how much more space we really needed. And so it's kind of an eye-opening experience to come in, to take a tour, to realize what the really big need is and how much space we really need to be able to provide all these meals. 4.5 million meals might seem like a lot, but we've been doing that out of a 12,000 square foot barn. But the need is 17 million just to meet the need here at Lake and Porter County. So we do need a bigger facility. And so I think when people hear about this, come tour, their eyes open up. Their awareness of the need and what we're trying to do is really changes their perception of hunger and food insecurity and what we're trying to do. And I've just seen so many people excited, happy, congratulating us. But really, it's a community center. We want people to come in, to volunteer, to donate, to support this effort, because we can truly make a huge impact in this region.
I know typically that you don't rely on help necessarily from governmental agencies, in particular the places, organizations like the county commissioners here in Lake County and surrounding counties. But obviously there are ways that they, I'm sure, can probably help the food bank out, aren't there?
Yeah, so we try to leverage any opportunities to help our cause. And so if it's with individual donors, corporations, businesses, even the USDA, we provide a lot of the USDA governmental programs, CSFP, TFAP. We're leveraging those opportunities to benefit our mission. And so we continue to do that. If it's community development block grants to help retrofit our facility, we're trying to explore that opportunity because we rely on individual and donor support. Majority of our revenue comes locally, and it stays local. So it's important for us to try to turn over every rock and stone to make sure that we're trying to get every dollar possible to make this vision that we're trying to do a reality.
Steve Beekman, thanks for being with us to talk about this.
Yes, thank you.
Steve Beekman is the executive director of the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana. The food bank is physically moving its location in Gary to 6490 Broadway in Merrillville.
Hoosiers experienced the hottest May ever recorded since records began nearly 150 years ago. National Weather Service says 25 days in the month of May reached over 80 degrees. Meteorologist Kitty Hoover says the spike is because Indiana gets a lot of the current air currents out of the Gulf of Mexico, and currently the warm temperatures are not consistent with what has happened in previous months.
We kind of switched from, winter to summer directly this year. So April is actually below average for both Bloomington and Indianapolis.
And Hoover says that Hoosiers should expect more rain and thunderstorms than usual this coming summer. Some communities use wastewater from producing oil and gas to reduce the dust on country roads, and it is legal in 13 states, including Indiana, to do so. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Teal tells us there is a new study that shows the practice is likely to put a cancer-causing chemical into the air and water.
This oil and gas wastewater contains radium. High amounts of it have been linked to serious health issues, including bone cancer. When that water is spread on dirt and gravel roads, radium can wash off into waterways and possibly get into drinking water. Bill Burgos is a professor of environmental engineering at Penn State University. He co-authored the study. He says some of that radium also stays in the road.
Once that road dries and traffic is going on it and kicking up dust, some of the radium that was retained in the road could be mobilized through the dust.
Of course, breathing in dust alone can cause health problems. Burgos says states need to find a way to control dust that doesn't cause more pollution. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
The new chairman of Indiana's Alcohol Code Revision Commission says he doesn't yet have an agenda for the group, despite a history of opposing alcohol legislation in the Indiana General Assembly. Former Representative Bill Davis says he's only been able to do a little research into what the commission's been working on.
I have not ever been to one of their commission hearings, so I'm not real sure where they are in the process on a number of these issues, but I'm certainly more than willing and happy to work with these folks.
And Davis says he's not been in touch with anyone on the committee, including the former chair, Beverly Gard. House Speaker Brian Bosma made the announcement of the appointment late last month, noting that Davis's past experience with alcohol legislation, much of which he had shot down.
I still feel the same way I felt about making sure that we're moving the process forward in a way that is helpful to the people of the state of Indiana and in their best interest.
Former Representative Davis says he is not sure when he will hold as chairman the first meeting of this Alcohol Code Revision Commission. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.